And we're going to take your calls this hour with Manu Saifzadeh as we talk about his work under the Sphinx, an amazing story and research. Let's get ready with your calls when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Manu Saifzadeh with us. His book is Under the Sphinx, comes out in sometime in May or so. Manu, what would you say in all your research has been the one thing that you just find to be so fascinating?
Well, one of those things is this lost script from the northern part of Egypt. One of the symbols is the jaw sign, and that ended up being most important in this whole story. And I think that's one of the things that I'm interested in pursuing, is to see if that script can be resurrected. And there is a way that it might be able to do it, and I show that in the book, how I do it for the jaw sign. And so there's a possibility for further research in that direction. And then, of course, I'm interested to know if there's anything else that came out of this archive from the House of Life and leaked into the local cemetery where that painting ended up. So that's another direction that the research may take. So those are some projects that I might be looking at soon.
Do you believe the Sphinx came before the pyramids, the Great Pyramids?
Yes, for sure.
By how many years, what do you think?
Yeah, I say for sure. I think there was something there before the pyramids were put on top of it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so okay. We do have some, and I'm looking at this with Robert Bouval's brother, Jean-Paul, who's an architect. So Jean-Paul and I have been looking at the architecture of the Great Pyramid, and we think that the subterranean aspect of it came first, before the pyramid was put on top. So I should qualify that statement. But I think the Sphinx came first, yes. And I think you were asking how old. So I think about 10,000 BC. I think that's about the right time when that monument was created.
And when you say that monument was created, initially, was there anything there? Was it a big piece of rock?
Yeah.
What was
yeah.
it?
Yeah, that's what I think, right. And I think that's sort of the consensus in the field, that it was a yardang. A yardang is something that looks like it's man-made, or it looks like a face, like a head, something like that. And prehistoric people that may have come to Giza in those times, they felt inspired by that and then carved a monument into that. But there's another way that Robert Schock and I felt that what might have inspired them, and that is that there's a fissure that runs through the Great Sphinx. And so I think that fissure, we think that this fissure split the monument in two halves, and the ancient Egyptians actually felt that was symbolically important, and they made symbols from that based on the split line. And those symbols are among the oldest symbols that we know from hieroglyphic. So this is another part of the story that's really interesting, because what that means is that this monument, there's not just an archive that affected the culture of the ancient Egyptians, but the monument itself, the appearance of it, had a profound impact on the civilization and specifically the writing aspect of it. So that's probably some kind of rock formation, and it looked like something that could be a statue, and then it was basically carved into a lioness monument.
This painting that was painted on the coffin.
Yes.
Does it have a message behind it?
Yes, it does. That's a great question, George. There's something written around the painting, and that is a key inscription. And I go again through great lengths analyzing that inscription. It actually helped me to identify what the bands around the in the center, George, there is the image of the sun god in a very unusual way. You're not going to see that anywhere else in Egypt. And around the sun god are nine bands. And then there's an inscription around those nine bands. And that inscription is key in identifying what those nine bands are. That's one part of the deciphering effort. The other part is there's a map on the bottom of the coffins, George. That's called the map of the from the Book of Two. It's called the Book of Two Ways, and the Book of Two Ways has a map, and that map is painted on the bottom of those coffins. And that map also helped a lot. It was instrumental in basically deciphering what that painting means and what the inscription means.
Let's take some phone calls here with you. Let's start by going to Jason, truck driving in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Jace. Go ahead.
How you doing, George? Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
My question is, the pharaohs way back when that were, when they found something in the pyramids, when they had the manpower just to say, hey, let's dig everything up and find everything that we could find. Is that a possibility?
You're talking about the archaeologists when they were excavating the pyramids?
Yes, with the pharaohs at the time, did they have the power to say, hey, dig all this stuff up?
I think, well, based on the fact that, based on what I'm thinking that this was breached, I would say partially, at least I would say yes, Jason. So I think that archive was breached, and in order to breach it, they had to, I don't think it was just fully exposed. I think they must have somehow been able to enter it. Either they went from the front where the Sphinx Temple is, or they were somehow able to come at it from another entry, maybe from the Osirian shaft. I don't know if you know what that is, but further west there's a shaft that goes way down into the plateau, and so there must have been another access. So I think so. I think the answer is partially, at least, yes, that they would have somehow had to excavate or remove some dirt to get access to this chamber, and then they took out whatever was in it and moved it to another location at some point.
Didn't Napoleon's soldiers shoot out part of the face on the Sphinx?
No, that was him. That's a great question, George. But it wasn't him. It was because we have actually it's not a painting. It's a sketch from I don't want to misquote this. I think it's a Danish explorer that went to Egypt and drew the Sphinx with the nose already off.
Huh. Before Napoleon.
To 1700 something. I can't remember right now.
And Napoleon was in the 1800s.
Yeah, that's right. So it wasn't Napoleon's soldiers. No, the nose was. And there's, by the way, there's an Arab historian that talks about this things being mutilated. So this probably happened sometime during medieval times.
Do you speak Arabic or Farsi? Or both?
Farsi.
Okay, cool. Joe, Long Island, New York, welcome to the show. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Great discussion. Two quick questions.
Yes.
One would be the Greeks had their version of the Sphinx.
Yes.
And did those two versions, the Egyptians and the Greek, in any way contemplate each other?
That's an excellent question. Excellent question. Love it. I actually will talk about this a little bit in Contact in the Desert, but so I can tell you that the Sphinx the depiction in antiquity, the interesting thing is those sphinxes are female, first of all, and they have wings. They have something coming out of the back, and that's exactly what we're seeing in the iconography of the early dynastic times when we see Mehid. So it turns out Mehid has the jaw sign coming out of her back. So that's sort of the equivalent of the wing in the later sphinxes. And it is a female. It's a lioness. It's not a male lion. And so it's interesting that the Greeks sort of captured the correct gender. They captured this thing out of the back. And then, but they turned this into sort of a completely different creature, a mythical creature. But so, yes, I think the true origin of the Great Sphinx, which I think is Mehid, the lioness, and Robert Schock and Robert Bouval, we all published this in 2017. So I think the true origin is still hidden in some of the inscriptions and some of the icons that came much later, including Greco-Roman times. So that's a great question.
If you were able to get into a time machine, Manu, where would you go?
I would go to the year 2950. To the time of Horus Jer, the third king of Egypt.
B.C., right?
In his tomb, there is a wooden tablet that that shows, actually, a temple with a sitting lion in front of it. So I have as close to a Polaroid picture by a tourist, an ancient tourist, as you can come, George. I would love to see the Giza Plateau in 2950 B.C.,
Oh, that would be fascinating, wouldn't it? Oh, my gosh. And do you think you would see anything that you suspected?
I think I would see exactly what I'm seeing on that wooden tablet. And this is something we published. That's actually available We made all these papers available to the public, George. So Robert Shaw, Robert Vaughn, and I, we published four papers together. And all of these are on my academia page. They're on the journal website, and they're free access for anyone to check them out. So if you're interested. I don't know if I have my academia page on your website, but it's easy. You just Google my name. I'm on academia.eu. You can just go visit, get the papers. And if you're interested in the book, we have a pre-sale. And that link is, I think, also on the Coast to Coast AM website.
Yeah, we've got that link set up for you. Let's go to Barry in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hello there, stranger. Welcome.
Boy, oh boy, George, what a great show tonight. I'm telling you, I'm having a ball. And one of my all-time favorite subjects, Egypt and so forth.
Good.
And I've got a good question for your guest. But first of all, George, tomorrow night, Billy Gibbons is going to be on the show.
Yep, Bill and Tommy set him up. Billy wants to chat a little bit. Ian will be doing the program, so they're going to have a fun time.
Oh, boy, I'll be calling in with sharp-dressed man. But great question, but how does your guest correlate ancient Egypt and so forth with Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which is 12,000 years old?
Right.
What's his feeling on that? And hello to all my buddies and friends out there in Coast to Coast land. And thanks, George. I'll be off there until next time.
Okay, Barry. What about Göbekli Tepe and its comparison to the pyramids and the Sphinx?
Yeah, great question. We think that there is writing on those pillars. So Robert Chuck and I published a paper just recently, a couple of years ago, where we basically were able to reconstruct one of the symbols on the main pillar. And so we think that that symbolism is what actually fueled the congregational effect of this whole complex. So I think part of the effect on how society advanced from that original culture in Göbekli Tepe has to do with symbolism and how it was able to unite people from their sort of scattered otherwise existence as hunters and gatherers. And this happened around the same time that we're saying that the original monument in Giza was made. So Göbekli Tepe, the first circle dates to about 9500 BC, and Mehit in our reconstruction 10,000 BC, so it's approximately at the same time. But ultimately, Göbekli Tepe, the original monuments may predate that 9500 BC. So this could be pre-Diluvian. You know, if there was a epic disaster sometime around 9700 BC, then those monuments may have been there earlier. So there may be a connection. So that's a great question. So there may be a connection between those monuments in ancient Armenia, ancient Anatolia, that area, and in Egypt.
Manu, are schools teaching our kids the proper knowledge of ancient archaeology?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I think what schools should be teaching is for people to have a critical way to process the information that we're being given. So I think it's better, instead of teaching a certain version of history, I think it's better to equip people so that they can stand on their own feet and analyze the information so that they come up with their own conclusions, as opposed to just being fed what the conclusions are. Because it turns out that every once in a while we get a major upheaval of what we think is the truth, and it'll take people by surprise, you know. But I think it would be better to have a little bit more analytical teaching instead of just consuming the information.
West of the Rockies, Eric's with us now, Ocean Shores, Washington. Eric, welcome to the program.
Good evening, George. Thank you very much for having me on tonight.
Absolutely. Enjoy.
I'm so happy to be on this program. I've talked to you one time before, about maybe 15 years ago.
Wow.
And yep. And I was living. I tried to get through many times. Everybody tries to call, and it's
not easy.
But I was in Russian River area in Forestville, and when I called you, and we talked about having a visitation with a star traveler.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
And this is connected to Nanu, in my opinion, who the pharaoh actually is. And the Sphinx, Sphinx is, in my opinion, the goddess Bastet. And I had a visitation with, I think, her and her Black Panther and many years ago. And then just recently, before this reset with the COVID virus, I had, I think, maybe four or five or six ET groups bring me different pictures of things. And I can't go into it too much right now on the air. I want to be private, George, with you and
okay.
possibly text some of this stuff to you. And it is all about the reset and the loss of love of the beautiful blue. And the ETs are upset with the way they were treating the Earth. And it's all connected. The sun god is Bastet's father. And she is one of the daughters of Bastet. It's one of the daughters of the sun god, Ra.
Let's get Manu's take on some of this before the break. About the ET connection, Manu.
Well, I was just going to say, it's interesting that the call, I didn't catch the name, but...
Eric.
George, okay. He's mentioning Bastet, so it's the irony is that the jaw sign in the reconstruction that I talk about in the book actually means Babu, which is the same as Bastet. So Babu, Bastet, it means the same thing, and in the Sumerian language that means opener. So it's interesting that the caller is coming up with this, because that's exactly what I found means. Is the meaning of the symbol, and the symbol is associated with the lioness. And the caller, of course, is mentioning Bastet because that's also the name of a feline goddess. So yeah, that's how it happens. You know, you have somebody talking about these things, and then you have this overlap. So yes, I agree with Bastet, and I agree with the feline deity. Yes.
Interesting. Good job there, Eric. Yeah. It, wasn't Babu the nickname for Mahatma Gandhi as well?
I don't remember that.
I think that's what they used to call him.
Hmm.
Interesting take there. I wonder what it means in Indian.
So the boo part of Babu, that's actually in Egyptian, is the same word as set. And both of those words mean place. And Babu means the place of the soul. So Bastet or Bubastis is the name of the city up in the delta. Was basically the main oil production place in ancient Egypt. And so that is how this whole story came together, George, because the shipping labels that were put on the jars that were then sent to the south to the king's tomb, they had these symbols written on them. And one of the symbols is the jaw sign. And then another symbol has to do with oil and tributes. And that is what ended up helping me to put this all together.
Okay, and I think also Babu means sign of respect in Indian, and that's what they called Mahatma Gandhi. It makes sense, doesn't
okay.
it?
There you go, yes.
All right, we're going to come back in just a moment and take final phone calls with Manu, so get ready to let your fingers do the walking. Don't forget to pick up our free YouTube channel by just going to YouTube, type in Coast to Coast AM Official. We've gone over the 400,000 subscriber mark with that, and it's free, so give it a try. I hope you enjoy it. Everybody should be participating in that. And then like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and we will be back with final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Manu saves the day with us. His book, Under the Sphinx, comes out in a couple weeks, so keep monitoring that. We'll post something on the coasttocoastam.com website when it comes out indeed. Manu, I wanted to thank you for staying up so late, too. I know you're on the West Coast, but it's still very late in the night.
I'm wide awake, George.
Perfect, perfect. I hope you get great response to this interview tonight.
Yes, thank you.
You were on our show... about 2.5 years ago, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I think it was October 18 with Jimmy.
Yep, exactly. It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
Let's go to the phones. They're lining up for you. Wayne in Tacoma, Washington's with us. Hey, Wayne, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen, and thank you, Kurt. Thank you very much for taking
the call. Sure thing, Wayne. The voice of God is on the phone.
Manute. That's a little too heavy there, George. Manute, wanting to find out about salt crystals. I read there's salt crystals in the Great Pyramid.
Right.
I think this goes up to 450 feet, so evidence that went through the Great Flood of possibly probably very clear in the Sphinx also. Tell me what you know about that.
Well, the only thing I know about this is that when the shafts from the Queen Chamber were opened, there was apparently some kind of residue on. And so you have to remember the shafts were supposedly completely sealed for, since the Great Pyramid was made. And so there was some kind of residue inside, yes. And you're probably familiar with Chris Dunn's work, and I think Christopher has a take on that.
Yeah.
But that's all I know about salt deposits on the Great Pyramid.
I'm fascinated, Manu, by the possibility that the Hall of Records may be flooded out.
Yes.
And submerged totally. And as you were saying, Chucks thinks that it's better to stay underwater permanently rather than dry up, get wet, up, get wet again. But
even George, if there is nothing, if the archive was completely moved, it would still be interesting to access this void and to see if it's man-made and if there's any other clues that tell us that there used to be something in it. I bet you there will be something of interest. Even if it's flooded, even if it's empty, there is something we'll find out that will help us.
And I'm sure they could pump it out pretty fast,
yes.
Couldn't they?
Yeah, according to Robert, Schock told me that it would have to be very slowly drained, and you would be able to salvage some of the relics. If whatever was in there, you could salvage it. If you slowly drain the swampy water out of it.
What we don't know is if it was raided 2, 3, 4, 5,000 years ago.
That's right. Well, I think it was opened 5,000 years ago. So, and because otherwise there would be the painting wouldn't have leaked out, right? So the fact that I'm finding the painting and that I can, that this is a very esoteric piece of art that really doesn't fit into ancient Egypt, that in and of itself tells us that the archive was opened.
Were you the first one to find the painting?
No, I'm not the first one to find the painting, but the few Egyptologists that have looked at this painting, they don't know what to do with it, George. They have not been able to explain it. And, of course, that makes sense because even if they were to conclude that this is an astronomical depiction of our solar system, they would say, well, that's not possible, right? And so, therefore, they had a very interesting explanation for what they think this is, which is basically they don't have an explanation. And I have two quotes in the book where a couple of scholars made a comment about it, but that's about it. And so this is wide open. When I saw this painting for the first time, George, immediately I realized there's something wrong with this picture. This does not fit into ancient Egypt.
Are you baffled by it?
Yes, I was baffled.
Next up, Caroline's with us in Wichita, Kansas, east of the Rockies. Hello, Caroline.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. Go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question, and clarify for me, because I get my names mixed up with all those different names.
Sure.
But after Atlantis, and then they spread them off to six places or something, wasn't Saw the one that went in the bottom of the Sphinx?
Caroline, who did you say went to the bottom of the Sphinx?
Well, I mean, where he goes like every 6,500 years, and he comes up and educates whoever wants to listen with all the latest and greatest technology, and then they all put it all to use, and then it kind of goes way up high, and then it slows down for 6,500.
But who's he, Caroline? Who's he?
So, is it T-H-O-T-H? Is that how you say it?
Oh, Thoth. Okay, I see. That's a very interesting question. You know, when you said 6,500, I immediately thought about a processional quarter. That's about the time it takes for a quarter of a processional cycle, and that is actually, I mentioned in my book, I talk about, because if you remember, Graham Hancock and Robert Bouval published a book in 97, I think it's called Message of the Sphinx, and the way that they put this together is that the Hall of Records contained this information about precession. And they said that basically the entire Giza Plateau with the three pyramids and the Sphinx is a processional clock that you can wind backwards. And when you do that, in other words, you take the sky and you change the sky until it matches what's on the ground. And then you are in 10,000 BC. And when you just mentioned 6,500 years, Immediately, I thought about this processional cycle because that's about how much it takes to go from one station, let's say from the equinox station to one of the solstice stations. That takes about 6,500 years. And in the book, I do talk about the moon, which is Thoth. So it's interesting you brought this up, Carolyn. I don't know all the details of what you're asking me, but you rang a couple of bells.
Interesting. Your website also is called CheopsPyramid.com, right?
That's correct.
All right, Caroline, thank you for being on the program. Really appreciate it. Next up, let's go to Thomas in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Hey, Thomas, go ahead.
Hey, Joe, it was a good guest tonight.
Yo, he's super, yeah.
You know, I have a few comments to make, including a Bible verse, so I was hoping your guest would get his attention or his opinion on it.
Okay.
Well, flying cars and helicopters and submarines depicted in hieroglyphs?
Yes, and
I think they're real. Powered by Baghdad batteries on a larger scale.
Have you seen the glyphs of Abydos, Manu?
I'm sorry, I missed the question. What was the question again?
Have you seen that etching in Abydos of what looks like a helicopter and a submarine?
Oh, yes, yes. I have seen it, yes.
How do you explain that?
Well, I think I'm with Robert Bouvalge, Robert Schock. I think we're all agreeing that this was created when you had an overlay between two different inscriptions, and when you overlay those two, and I recognize the symbols even. I can even see the individual hieroglyphs that when you superimpose them, that you would get what the caller is asking about. So I think that is not, those symbols were not from one individual instance of carving, but they were basically two different sets of symbols that were overlaid, and that's how you got that image. And there's a pretty good proof of that, actually.
But they still are bizarre-looking images.
They are bizarre-looking images. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing... it's obviously coincidental, but it's an amazing coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I think they were either futurists... or they had that kind of technology.
There is a different take on that. Yes, I'm aware of it, yes.
Thomas, let's go with your second question. Go ahead.
Well, the secret anti-gravity that I believe they used to power those vessels is depicted on the door of the Crystal Garden, is it, in Florida? This guy built by himself.
Anything about anti-gravity in your research, Manu?
I'm in conversation with an author, Gary Osborne. You probably know him. He just published a paper about the Rendlesham Forest incidents. And we're talking about the code, the Penniston Code. And part of those conversations we've touched on that subject. There is some physics involved, yes. But it's too early for me to really comment on it because I'm not sure. And so but I think when Gary comes out with a book, there's going to be some interesting information that relates to that.
Off to Missoula, Montana, it's Richard's turn. Welcome, Richard. Go ahead.
Hey, George.
Howdy.
First time, long time. And
Thank you.
And with all due respect to your guest, I just had a question. Your guest from last night, he kept talking about the giants.
Yeah.
And then we're talking about the pyramids. What do you think about the giants that built the pyramids?
You know Michael Tellinger, Manu.
Yes.
And Michael, of course, believes the pyramids were constructed by ETs, perhaps, but giants that they did this. It was easy for them to move the blocks.
Right. I've heard about this. I don't know either way, but I can tell you that where the major question that we still have with the Great Pyramid has to do with how the stones were lifted to the top. There's theories how that may have happened, different theories, but at this point we still don't know. And if something like your caller's asking was involved in this, that's maybe where you could fit it in. But I have absolutely no evidence personally. I know there's other authors, there's other researchers that pursue this. Jim Vieira, for example, he's one of my friends. But personally, I have really nothing to add to that question.
All of this, the Sphinx, the pyramids, it's still fascinating, isn't it? My gosh.
The Sphinx is a giant, right? So if you're talking about giants, there you go. You have a giant lion statue.
David's with us in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I had one question.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if it's exactly germane to what you're talking about online, but my question is, why would the Egyptians, over all these centuries and years, allow people to come into their country and dig up their undead, their ancient dead? I mean, they don't come to our country and dig up our dead.
Good question. Why did the Egyptians allow anybody to dig up the dead?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was actually thinking about the same thing today when I was reading about the stash of mummies that were recently excavated. I agree. I think sometimes you wonder if that's desecrating their peace. And yes, I guess there is a balance between archaeology and leaving people to rest. I don't know. I do have those sentiments, too. I agree with the caller.
Yeah, it is. You know, we don't think about that very often. But
it's a really good question.
It's desecration, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is, yes.
I mean, how would we feel if somebody came up to us and said, you know, we want to dig up your cemetery where all your soldiers are buried or stuff like that?
I mean, maybe in some people's belief system, we leave this earth and, you know, our soul is in the sky and maybe we don't care. But in the belief system of the ancient Egyptians, the mummified body was actually a vessel that the spirit revisited, and also received nourishment from the family members. So to them, that was actually an important part of being coming back, resurrect. And so what the caller is asking is a very justified question.
Joe in the Bronx on the wild card line. Joseph, go ahead.
Hey George, how are you?
Good, Joe. Thank you.
Good. Manu, I wanted to ask you about the recent uncovering of Luxor.
Yes.
And they found some tools at the site. What else of substantial interest are they finding there?
You mean, are you talking about the Golden City?
Go ahead, Joe.
Yes.
You're talking about the Golden City. Okay.
Luxor.
Yeah. Interesting, I think... The most, to me personally, the most interesting thing about that is the walls, the wavy walls. I found that interesting, that architecturally, why they made those walls in that way. And other than that, my understanding is this is sort of an extension of a worker village that already was known to exist before, and this is just another segment of that worker village. And so... that part is not that interesting to me, unless maybe something will be found that hasn't been talked about yet. But to me, the walls are interesting, that wave-shaped wall.
Manu, we're running out of time. Again, the book comes out in a couple of weeks.
Right, and we're in pre-sale right now, so you're welcome to go to the publisher's website. The link is on your website under the show tonight. So people interested can pre-purchase the book from the link.
Good research on this, by the way,
thank
Under
you.
The Sphinx. And you've been in good company with Bival and the Shock.
Yes. Thank you for having me on the show, George. And thanks to your staff, Tom and Gina and Stephanie, for making this such an easy experiment.
And good luck at Contact in the Desert. We'll both be there by Zoom this year. So let's see what happens. Okay, my friend. Be well.
Okay.
Super. And don't forget to check in with Ian Punnett tomorrow. His guest will be Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top, one of our favorite show folks. And they're going to have some fun with those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. For Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then. Be safe, everyone.